I'm Joanna Shanks.
I'm Emma Taylor.
And this is Murder, She Spoke.
I was going to tell you about a new show that I started watching on Netflix. I think we've both watched the kind of, is it 80s or 90s version, Unsolved Mysteries? I think it's the same show. It's called the same thing. So either it's a reboot or they've just totally nicked the name. But yeah, it's pretty good so far.
The original one that I remember had some like really cheesy, dramatic host. I can't remember what his
Do you
name
not have
was.
white hair, like quite?
Yeah, maybe because I get mixed up because there was another one that I used to watch, which I can't remember what it's called, but it was a similar time 90s, and it was like a really dramatic host called Sheriff John Bunnell.
Oh, yeah. Okay,
And
no.
this guy, whatever the program was that I used to watch with him in it, he had white hair and he's always like permatan, so he's like orange. I remember there was one episode I watched, and the guy that they were chasing in the car was like a DJ, and I remember he was like, "The only record this guy'll have is a criminal record." And like it was like that kind of cheesy shit. And I remember years ago, somebody showed me a YouTube video. It was somebody impersonating him, and they had this white wig on, and they'd sellotaped cotton wool over their eyebrows, and they were like rolling over the bonnet of a car. And I swear to God, it was so funny. But
Oh, I
yeah,
love ones
I
like
can't remember
that.
what the program was called.
That is amazing. Yeah, no, so apparently the guy that I remember hosting is Robert Stack, but he apparently there was an original host, but I don't really remember that one. Robert Stack's the one that I remember, and yeah, it was 87 onwards for 581 episodes, which is amazing.
581 episodes.
Yeah, so
Because
I'm willing to go back and listen, like watch them all,
because
definitely.
if I'm scrolling through the TV guide and there's nothing on, if I saw some old Unsolved Mysteries, I'm like, hell yeah, and I'll put it on, and it's, forensics are just sort of coming around, and it's so
Yeah,
cheesy, but I love it. But
totally.
also another guilty pleasure when there's nothing on is Judge Judy.
Yes, she's so sassy. I love her.
I watched it. It happened to be on one day, and I was just like, "Oh, I'm actually kind of enjoying this." And I don't normally watch trash TV,
Yeah.
and I would class it as trash TV, but I was definitely enjoying it.
I don't know, some of them are, I get quite invested in them. Like, I find myself rooting for one person or the other usually.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I get really annoyed. I'm like, yeah, but she loaned you that money. You were meant to give it back. Like, as if it means anything to my life whatsoever. But yeah. Yeah, no. So we watched the first one, which is about a guy called Ray Rivera. It's about his death, his mysterious death, which is still undetermined. It's pretty interesting. I would watch it, and it's got his wife and his family in it, and they go back to where he was found and talk over the details of the autopsy and that kind of thing. And yeah, there's some interesting things surrounding his a friend of his who was also his employer at the time, who was the last person, well, someone in that office was the last person to call him, and they've just totally refused to deal with law enforcement. They've lawyered up, so it looks pretty suspicious. But initially, the police were just going to rule it a suicide. It seems like something's happened to him, but nobody really knows. They're obviously hoping that as a result of this, someone will come forward. But yeah, no, I just like the way that they told the family's story, but it wasn't too much. It wasn't like a sob story. It was quite interesting. And he left behind a really weird note that could have been in code as well, that he'd hidden behind his PC. Yeah, it was pretty interesting. I'd watch it.
Sounds good. So is it anything like the original one? Has it got anything to do with the original one, or is it, do you think it's just completely different?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. I think they might have just used the name, and it definitely suckered me in. So I was like, ooh, yeah,
Yeah, I
that looks
mean,
good.
I know what I'm watching in bed tonight.
Seriously,
No,
let me know what you
I am being serious.
think. I know you too well. I should have really known that. Yeah, you need to let me know what you think of it. I enjoyed it.
I love, you know, if you're getting into bed at night and you know when you're like, I don't really want to watch something, but I kind of want something on, you know, in the background or whatever, putting on something like Forensic Files and just letting it play like episode after episode and just fall asleep to it. I'm just so relaxed and happy.
The only thing I find with that and with all the podcasts and documentaries and books and so on and so forth is sometimes cases bleed into each other and I get a little bit confused and I'd be like, oh, is that the one where he made a belt of nipples or was that the guy with a lampshade?
I am definitely with you there.
Was he some of the mummy issues or was he the stabby guy?
Yeah.
Too much, Emma. Pull it back. But yeah, so that's what I've been up to.
I started watching a new program on Netflix, not true crime related, but I'm always looking for a nice series to watch, you know, something I can really get into. And I'm really picky. I try ones that other people tell me are good and I'll maybe watch one or two episodes and I just don't get into it. It takes a lot to hook me in. I think especially with fiction these days. So I saw The Sinner.
Yes.
With Bill Pullman. And I thought, oh, you know, this looks interesting. I'll do the thing where I'll give it 15 minutes and if it's rubbish, I'll turn it off. So I thought I'll pop this on. I was in bed and, you know, fancied something new to watch. I'll give this a try. Give it the 15-minute rule. And I really enjoyed it. So we've watched a few episodes now. I think we're maybe about 4 episodes in. I'm really enjoying it and I'm quite intrigued. I can't tell where it's going to go, but yeah, I'm liking it. So that's really the only new thing I have this week because everything else is just me consuming all my favourites. I did sign up to Patreon for the first time ever for Swindled because it is just such a good podcast. There aren't many that I stick with. You know, I generally jump around and like to have a mix a bunch of stuff and go through little phases. But Swindled is one of the ones that it's a complete go-to for me. And I've consumed so much of it and I thought it's really only right that I support it on Patreon. So I did that.
I like to hear of people supporting other podcasts as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I know that you had it queued before. You hadn't given it a try. The only thing I would say is that sometimes if you listen to it too much, it can leave you feeling a little bit jaded. Mm. As strange as it sounds, you know, when I'm sort of consuming true crime stuff, I'm generally quite resilient to it. But with Swindled, it's usually about big corporations screwing people over and stuff. And I believe that people are inherently good. I have faith in people. I do. I like people. I have faith in humanity. This podcast slightly destroys that. But, you know, I'm trying to sort of take it lighthearted, you know, not really like take it to heart. But sometimes you can come away from it feeling a bit, but it is very, very good. It's well presented and really well researched as well. So
I struggle with that a little bit with corporations, especially when I see them behaving poorly. I struggle to see them as an entity. I see them as an embodiment of values, and it really is telltale for me how they act. And I ended up in a Facebook argument. I don't know if you saw this on my own Facebook page. Totally bizarre, came out of nowhere. I reposted about a local cat cafe that are doing takeaway drinks to try and keep themselves open during COVID and so on and so forth. And a guy that I used to work with in the pub way, way back when I used to work in pubs, posted saying, oh, you can get unlimited tea and coffee for £1 in Witherspoons. Obviously, the cat cafe are charging kind of normal, I think it's like £2.50 for a cup of tea, which, yeah, you know what, it is what it is. It's city centre Edinburgh. And I went back saying, yes, but you're not supporting a small business to try and keep them open during a difficult time. And also, Witherspoons have treated their staff like shit during the pandemic. So I don't want to support them either way. And he's like, well, I've been treated fine. I don't know what the problem is. So I don't think I was annoyed. I didn't really want to get into an argument, but I did literally go in Google articles and just posted them and was like, here's where the head of Witherspoon says he's not going to pay staff because he can't afford to. Here's when he actually did pay the staff, because it turns out he could afford to because the government came through with the furlough scheme, but he still manages to cover it between those times. Then he said he wasn't going to pay suppliers, the alcohol suppliers. Right at the start, he said he wasn't going to shut the pubs because he didn't believe, you know, that it was going to make any difference. So it's all these kind of things. And like, I wasn't exactly a Witherspoon's frequenter in the first place, but would I go now? Absolutely not. Not in a million years. I made it incredibly clear that this isn't about the staff. It's about, you know, the way that the company is being managed. And the, I think he's the CEO. He's the owner. He's a millionaire. And, you know,
it's Tim Martin, isn't it?
Tim Martin, yeah. And he's just a vile human being.
Yeah, so. I've heard about it in the news as well. And for any of our listeners overseas who don't know what Wetherspoons is, it's a large pub chain in the UK. I don't know if they're outside the UK, if it's just within the UK.
I don't think so.
The pubs never have any music on. There's never an atmosphere. But, you know, cheap drinks.
It is a bit of a UK institution because young people who are just starting to go out and drink, who can't afford to go to nice places, to be honest, they would go there first and they'd get a couple of pints for, you know, a few quid and then go somewhere nice and then spend a bit more money. Or older people, I think, like to go and just sit and share a bottle of wine, because if you can get a bottle of wine in Witherspoon's for £9 and you don't have a lot of cash, by all means, you know, like you want to go out and still enjoy yourself. There will still be people that have to go because of the pricing, and that's absolutely fine. But I think if you've got the option and you don't have to support that and line his pocket further, personally, I wouldn't.
Absolutely.
But yeah, Emma ending up in arguments on the internet again. Yay, just another night in. Oh, I can't help myself. I was really biting my tongue. It was the me copying and pasting links that I thought, is that a bit far? I don't know.
Well, they usually say, oh, where's your evidence? Where's your proof? So the fact that you're backing up your... There's a difference between having an informed opinion and just having an uninformed opinion. And I think when you have an informed opinion and you can back it up, then...
It's harder to argue with.
Yeah, but also, like, your opinion is actually research. You have to have knowledge about something to have an opinion. And if you don't know about it, then you can't have an opinion.
I think it was oh my God, I'm so confused. I think it was also because he works for the company. He's going to be a bit defensive, and I absolutely get that. And I didn't want to be like... Lol, I'm never going to give money to the business you work for ever again. Like, you know, I didn't want to come across like that. So I was trying to make it clear that it was the actual owner that I've got an issue with. But yeah, it is what it is.
Yeah, it wasn't a personal attack.
No, absolutely not. But yes, that's what I've been up to. So for my case today, it's the one that was suggested by one of our followers. There's not a lot of information, so I had to pay to get access to newspaper records and like read through all the articles. So in my kind of evidence, I've got screenshots, like little clippings from articles, which is quite good fun to do.
Okay.
But when you Google her, two links come up.
Oh.
It's hardly anything. So unfortunately, the only newspaper from the time that seems to have had any pictures of her isn't available without actually going into, I think it's Chambers Street or wherever the records are held, because it's the Scottish Daily Record and they're only held online up until something like 1950, which is really annoying. So I've got the text, but I can't get a picture of it. But hopefully, if someone's listening to this and knows of her, theoretically, they may be able to provide us with a picture. So
yeah.
So it's the case of Mandy Barnett, Amanda Barnett. It's from April 1996. And the person that got in contact with us, it was because of the Anne Ballantyne case, which happened in Fountain Bridge. And they and their mother had memories of that case happening. And then roughly 10 years later, still in the Fountain Bridge area, this woman was murdered as well. So they remembered the details. So she was 22 years old. She was a mother of one, and she was from Luton originally. She had lived in Edinburgh about 4 years. She'd moved up and she worked in the nightclub Subway. Do you remember Subway?
Yes.
Yep. So she worked in there and she'd moved up. It seems that she'd had a bit of a dispute with her parents. She lived with her parents down in Luton. So her parents are called Terry and Pam Barnett. They didn't actually know that their daughter was there. They didn't know that's where she was. So when her body was found, police were trying to track her family, which is quite sad. But they did say that they had spoken to her fairly recently, but I don't think they knew the full details of where she was. I don't know why. She sounds like she'd had a bit of a disagreement with them and she didn't really want them to know much about what she was up to. She was going out with a man called John Balsillie, who was 39. He was actually in Sawton jail at the time. It was him that raised the alarm. He used to speak to her twice a day, and her friend said that it was almost like a religious thing that she would be there at those times every single day and she would speak to him, and that was their thing. So when he never heard from her, he called the police, and it was Friday the 26th of April in 1996. So he called the police. He was really concerned. What had happened was a guy that he knew from jail was out on a weekend release, had gotten Mandy's details to go and ostensibly do a drug deal. Essentially, he went round saying that he had, I think it was weed for her boyfriend. And when he was there, he got her to speak to John. So this would have been in the morning, I would presume, because they usually spoke twice a day and he was due to speak to her later on. He spoke to John on the phone, but he gave a false name. And he said that his name was Todd, which his name wasn't Todd. His name was Joseph McGinley. So he was 40 years old at the time and he was out on release, but he was actually in jail with a life sentence for murder already of another young woman in 1974, which I'll touch on in a bit. So he spoke to him, and because John thought that the call was being recorded, he didn't raise any alarms, but he recognised his voice, and he'd given other convicts Mandy's details before, so she wasn't particularly concerned, and she realised that he knew who he was, and that was fine. Next thing that we know, he never heard from her again. He raised the call to the police and the police went round and found her. She'd been stabbed with a 10-inch blade through the heart and strangled with part of her shower. It's a shower attachment. And she's partially nude and had been dumped in her own bath. The killer had then filled the bath with warm water to try and evade the police so that they wouldn't know when exactly she'd been murdered. And that was what they found. They didn't even know exactly where she came from. They couldn't find her family, and there's no talk of it, but she had a child as well. So it must have been horrendous trying to work that out. And the boyfriend, whilst he was in jail and he is a convicted murderer, was obviously beside himself, and it was him that had raised the call. So the thing that really made this quite a shocking discovery, I think it was very unusual that the call had been raised by someone in the prison to raise the alarm that someone might have been murdered. There's not a huge amount of information about Amanda. She was petite, she had reddish brown short cropped hair and a stud through her nose. People said that she was really friendly, she was quite bubbly. We know that she had three older brothers, and she was actually due to move to a new flat the day that she was found. She spoke to John every day. She was visiting him all the time, always sending him cards. And she worked in the nightclub, and people just said that she was just a genuinely nice person, really bubbly, and just lots of pals that she had. So she clearly, you know, did have a lot of friends there as well. She didn't get on too well with her neighbours. She loved her music, apparently. Sometimes they were complaining that she played her music too loud. So I'm sure we can all identify with that. People were also talking a lot about the fact that her boyfriend, John Balsillie, was in jail. He was actually a convicted murderer as well. He was jailed for life in March 1977 for the murder of an 82-year-old widow. In 1993, he was released on parole, but in 1996, he was rearrested. He tried to break into a flat. It's very bizarre. He used his gyro to pay for a Valentine's Day treat for Mandy and then ran out of money. also tried to break into a house to steal, to cover it, which is very bizarre, but obviously shows that he obviously loved her a huge amount. So it's quite sad, really, that this is what happened. It seems like she had kind of got herself caught up in this, and she clearly loved him so much that, you know, when this guy turned up, she just went with it, which is horrible. So Joseph McGinley, who was the man that went to the house and subsequently was determined to have murdered Mandy, he's one of the few men in Scottish legal history to have been allowed out of prison and then murdered somebody again. There's a really small handful of people that this has happened. So when he was 18, he was from Dalmellington in Ayrshire. He was jailed for life at the High Court in Glasgow. He murdered a 16-year-old, Mrs. Elizabeth Casty, which just shows you, I can't even imagine being married at that age, but, you know, this is back in 1974. He also was sentenced for 10 years. He attempted to murder her friend, Josephine Humphreys. And when you read some of the reports of this, it's horrific. The little girl, I mean, 13 years old, she was found battered and bloodstained in a derelict tenement. Obviously, her friend who was married, Elizabeth, was dying next to her. And then she was weeping in the murder trial when she had to give the evidence. She was saying, "Joe's coming to get me, and I keep waking up screaming."
Oh, God.
I know. He was only 18 when he did this. He denied that he did it.
What was the motive?
They didn't actually say what the motive was. I mean, there's lots of speculation about lust for killing, and, you know, it does seem to be young, attractive females that he's murdered on both occasions. But with the first girl, she was, a young wife. And then there was another girl with her. He hit her on the head with his fist in a metal fire grate. She had to have 95 stitches in her face.
Bloody hell.
Yeah, and she's subsequently said, so at the next trial, when Mandy was murdered, she said that, you know, "I can't show my face, I have to wear my hair in a certain way because I'm covered in scars," mm-hmm. and that sort of thing, which is just horrendous. So there's a lot of anger surrounding the fact that McGinley, who was known to be such a brutal murderer, had been allowed out at all. It transpired that 2 years before he was given this opportunity, so it's a specific program that they had him out on. So at weekends, he would get to go, and it was like a freedom to get them ready for going back into the world.
Yeah, like a day release.
Yeah, but it was full weekends they were doing it for. So I don't know if is something that they would just do. It was called Training for Freedom, and it was from Nornside Jail in Forfar. And it would be a weekend they'd be allowed out. He would stay in a hostel in Edinburgh, and this was actually the third weekend that he'd been allowed out, and he'd only been out for a couple of hours before he came into contact with Mandy Barnett. So yeah, there was two other convicted killers that had been let out by the same prison at the same time that it turns out they were allowed to work alongside children and other vulnerable people. So there was a lot of concern around this Training for Freedom programme. And a couple of years before, he'd tried to smuggle drugs, and they determined that they still wanted to give him another chance. And then obviously he's gone and he's murdered Mandy. They actually got Mandy's boyfriend to come out of prison and help the police with the investigation, which is another thing that I found quite interesting, which I don't really know if it was because he knew the guy that did it. It wasn't to identify the body. It was a close friend that actually had to identify the body of Mandy. But her parents were just so relieved when he was finally sentenced. He was sentenced with a minimum of 30 years, which does mean that he will be eligible for parole in around about 7 years from now, which is slightly terrifying.
So did they manage to trace her parents quite quickly, or?
It doesn't look like it was quite quickly. It looks like it was within a week or so, which is still, I would argue, quite a long time if your daughter has been murdered. Her father, Mr. Terry Barnett, I've got a statement that he read out. "This last year of our lives has been a living nightmare." This is obviously since the murder, which hopefully we can now put behind us. "We're glad that the right verdict has been reached, and hopefully McGinley will spend the rest of his life behind bars. We feel that the people that let these violent people out for weekends, for drink, drugs, etc., should be answerable for their actions. Our lives are not going to be the same, but now we can start looking forward. And the jury didn't actually hear about McGinley's prior conviction until they had given their verdict, because they couldn't influence them. So the
inadmissible.
Yeah, absolutely. So they'd found out that he'd been convicted of assault with intent to ravish previously.
What's that?
I believe it's attempted rape. That's what we would call it now, but that was 1972, and he was sentenced to 2 years residential training, and then he was found guilty of murder and attempted murder of the girls in 1974. And yeah, so it's a bizarre case in so many ways. There's lots of really unusual things. You know, don't often cover cases that are solved, but the fact that he was out on release and murdered again, the fact that the boyfriend was in jail was very bizarre as well. And it does seem like there might have been a sexual element to it, because he'd removed some of her clothing as well. Yeah. But she was completely a stranger to him, totally innocent. She was a mother. She was going to be moving house. She'd moved away before and clearly had friends, had a job that she enjoyed. There was a couple of other interesting bits where he'd lied in many different ways. He seems to be quite a manipulative person, changed his story quite a few times. They knew that he was there because they'd spoken to the boyfriend in jail. He said, oh no, I went to visit my family. They went and spoke to the family and they said, yeah, no, he did come and see us. And they could tell that from the state of her body that the person who killed her would have had blood on them. So they had to question the family a number of times before they finally admitted that when he came to see them, he changed his clothes immediately as soon as he got through the door. Then they went back over the flat that she was in, realised it had been really deeply cleaned, and then found some specks of his blood. And that was what clinched it in the end. But yeah, his whole thing was, oh no, I wasn't there. I went to see my family. Oh wait, well, I was there, but I was just giving some cannabis to her so that she could give it to her boyfriend in jail. I mean, he was never going to get away with it. But it just infuriates me to think that this guy's been in jail and we've just kind of let him out for weekends to do what he wants, to prepare him for freedom. And that's in 1996. That's not that long ago.
How far into his sentence was that, do you know?
74. He was
96,
22. Yep.
22 years into what, a 25-year sentence or 30-year sentence?
I think it was 25 at that time, was the minimum.
Mm. Well.
But, you know, this is the thing that I really get stressed about in the UK, that they do have these, you know, kind of de-release things, even to this day, you know, when they get moved down the lower security prisons. I just can't understand that there's murderers who can do things like that. And it was to two different people that he did it, and they were young girls. And, you know, he had slip-ups throughout, and he'd had a previous conviction for the assault with intent to ravish. To have all that information at their disposal and then just to let him out anyway. And actually, you've got to wonder, her boyfriend, yep, sounds a lot like he definitely loved her to bits, but...
putting her in danger.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, I mean, I guess as well, like, normally you would think that people that would get out on day release and stuff like that to help prepare themselves, you would like to think that they're showing that they're reformed, but if somebody's had several instances where, you know, they're still up to no good, that doesn't reflect reform.
No.
And, you know, if somebody is still carrying on, then yeah, that's not an indication of reform and ready to turn their life around, is it?
There was one last bit of information to hopefully set our minds at ease a little bit. When he was sentenced, he attacked prison guards with a 4-inch skewer and tried to escape from custody. So they categorised him as a category A high risk prisoner. So I can only hope, surely only hope, that the justice system has learned its lesson with this guy.
You would like to think so.
Do you know what's sad though? Because the fact that it took him trying to attack prison guards with a skewer for him to be raised to a, you know, higher category risk when he's murdered two women, tried to rape someone else, and tried to murder another person.
Yeah. But it's only when he tries to, yeah, attack a prison guards with a skewer.
Yeah. So, like I said to you, unfortunately, we don't have a picture of Amanda just due to the age of the case. Unfortunately, a lot of it's all archived. And because of coronavirus, I can't go actually in to look at the archives. So it's all online, but they don't seem to, they just transcribe them. They don't put all the pictures on for those ones. But yeah, thank you for suggesting that. That was one of our followers on Facebook who suggested that, and it's one that I'd never heard of, and yeah, just a bit of an odd one.
I hadn't heard of that one either. That was interesting. Thank you for that, and enjoyed that.
Yeah, not a nice one, I'm afraid.
No, but hopefully some lessons have been learned, you'd like to think. Yeah. Nowadays
I just think it's really sad that we need to have things like that happen for lessons to be learned, because that's always the way, isn't it? That's always the way that we see these things happen.
Yeah, it's always reactive as opposed to proactive.
Yeah, and that's why I feel like sometimes we're too keen to look after the prisoners and too keen to look after the offenders and not actually really taking into account the victim's point of view. Can you imagine being Mandy Barnett's parents in that courtroom, knowing that the jury don't know anything about his prior convictions? That, I mean, to be fair, the information that was there and the evidence that they had was pretty solid, but still, you've seen people get off on cases that you think they're definitely going to be convicted on, and you must have just been dying to tell them. I would have just been like, come on, you need to know this information, even though you know they're not allowed to know it. That's one of the most frustrating things about me, about the justice system for me. I really hate that.
Yeah, it's like what we were saying about context.
Yeah,
for me. But then I guess the reason it's not admissible is because they don't want it to influence the jury.
I know, but if, I mean, I guess it does depend on the situation. However, if, for example, you've got someone who has murdered multiple people on different occasions and has been convicted multiple times, and you're not allowed to tell them about it, and maybe the evidence is a bit patchy, but they clearly did it. Like, it's just so frustrating, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I know. I get frustrated with it as well.
But especially because in America, like, when they try serial killers, they can kind of tie cases together. You know, they kind of present them in a different way. I know that they sometimes can't try them for all of the murders, and they sometimes have to exclude some of them because of lack of evidence and so on and so forth. But you know, you do see a lot of high profile trials happening where they have put together a case with multiple murders in one. I've not seen that happen in the UK. I wonder why that is.
Yeah, it must just be different, the different laws.
Very strange.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm hoping you've got a fun true crime fact for me.
I do. So I found a bunch of law and crime related facts relating to Scotland, which I thought was quite cool, given the fact that our podcast primarily focuses on cases in Scotland. So, did you know, if a stranger knocks on your door and asks to use your loo, for anyone outside the UK that's listening that doesn't know what a loo is a toilet or a restroom, you are legally obliged to let them. An extension of the old Scottish common law requiring hospitality to be shown to all guests, this law has never been formally authorised by Parliament, but is enforceable. It harks back to the days when travellers on foot would cross the land of neighbouring clansmen. It is widely accepted and remains commonly used by hillwalkers and hikers across Scotland.
Wow. That's a good one. I like that.
That's good, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, I do like when you read about weird laws that have never been revoked or Yeah, just really strange laws. America seems to have lots of really old, bizarre laws in different states that have just never been overturned. And it's like, you must only travel 42 kilometers on horseback with so much water, and like,
yeah,
just like really old, outdated ones that they've just never gotten rid of. And I kind of like those. They're quite
yeah,
cute.
Yeah, I think there are a few in Scots and English law. I actually have I do have a few of them here. So
can I have one more?
Yeah, of course, of course. Okay, you'll like this one. So, drunk and in charge of a cow in Scotland, that's illegal. Under the Licensing Act 1872, it is an offence to be drunk in charge of a carriage, horse, cow or steam engine, or whilst in possession of a loaded firearm. If found guilty of this offence, perpetrators could find themselves jailed for up to 51 weeks or fined £200.
Gosh, I wonder if the £200 is like not subject to inflation. That doesn't seem that much. I would quite happily pay £200 to be drunk in charge of a cow and a steam engine and a firearm.
Do you know, I've just realised on Monopoly, there's a community chest or chance and it's drunk in charge, fine £15.
That must be what that is.
Do you think that's what that is?
But is it drunk in charge of a cow?
But if you think about it, Monopoly was made in what, early 1900s?
Yeah, I mean, it's not going to be drunk in charge of a Lamborghini, is it?
But this Licensing Act was passed in 1872.
It must be.
So it could be.
I'm going to start telling people when we play Monopoly, that's what it is. The one that I could remember from America is that in Indiana, there is a place called French Lick Springs, which is an amazing name. Mm-hmm. And on Friday the 13th, it is legally enforceable that black cats have to wear bells.
Wow.
I know. Isn't that good?
That is really interesting.
There's loads of mad ones like that.
We would love to hear from you. If you have a case that you would like us to consider covering, you can contact us on our email address, info@murdershespoke.net. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. If you've enjoyed listening, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating or review. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.